think, check those things off on a daily basis, and you will see an absolutely different, a massive difference in your dog's behavior. Don't aspire for calmness, aspire for contentment. Because if you have a content dog, the dog will be calm as a byproduct of being content.
Are you crazy about Chihuahuas? Maybe you're wondering if a Chihuahua is the right dog for you. Perhaps you have a training or a behavior struggle. Well, look no further. Here you will find expert opinions, honest views, training and behavior advice, and much more on the Chihuahua Podcast. And now, allow me to welcome your hosts, Kate Masterton and Haley Miles. Over to you, ladies.
Welcome to the Chihuahua Podcast. I'm your host, Haley Miles, and this episode we have a very special guest as part of our Industry Expert series. Kate and I were very excited to be joined by the one and only world-renowned reinforcement-based dog sports coach, Kamal Fernandez. Kamal has over 27 years experience of training dogs. He has competed at crafts with his own dogs, and he runs his very own successful dog training business specializing in aggression and reactivity, and he teaches and speaks all over the world. But you may also have recently seen him on Channel 4's new program, The Dog Academy. In this episode, Kamal chats to us about the Dog Academy, but ultimately he talks to us about reactivity in Chihuahuas. Yes, we are talking about the number one behavior issue in Chihuahuas, and that is barking and lunging at other dogs on walks. This is not one to be missed. We thoroughly enjoyed talking to Kamal, and there are lots of takeaways in this episode.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Chihuahua Podcast. How was your weekend at Crofts, and have you recovered from your journey home?
Thank you. First off, thank you for asking me. It's a huge pleasure to speak to people like yourselves. I'm always really passionate to sort of talk to other dog fanatics and dog lovers and people that are interested in training their dogs. So firstly, thank you to you guys. Cross was amazing. We had a really great time. I had two dogs qualified for the obedience championships, and they were both dogs that I bred. So that was really, really sort of quite special as well. And we had my daughter and my partner and our niece came along with us. So it was a real family event, and it was great. Wow. The dogs did great. Crofts is a really challenging environment for dogs because there's so many people, so many things to consider in your preparation. But the dogs took it. One of them's been before, so we kind of knew how she would respond. But the younger dog, it was his first appearance at Crofts, and he hasn't actually competed a lot at that level. So it was a big step up for him, and he just took it all in his stride. So I couldn't be happier, to be truthful.
Oh, so it sounds like it was a success.
It was, from the dog's point of view, it was a huge success for both of them. She actually ended up getting placed, so which was nice. So she got fifth in the championship, which was great. One of my students won the championship. Another one got placed. So all as a coach and as a for myself and everything, it was a really, really great craft. So, yeah.
Wow. Okay. Sounds amazing.
You guys there?
Sorry. Crafts? No, we didn't. You were in Buckinghamshire, weren't you, Kate, with family?
Yeah, wasn't able to go, but I have been before, and it's a hectic environment, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lot. Really it's hectic. A lot. Yeah, you've got to sort of like, you need a rest before post crush, really. So that was definitely what I did on Monday.
Yeah. Everyone's walking around like zombies now. And I think a lot of people have actually got the crufts allergy as well.
Yeah, always. Yeah.
You know,
I've done in the past, I've gone from the Wednesday through to the Sunday. Well, I was doing things from every day at Crofts, like work, either competing or doing team events or stewarding. So, and I, honest to God, but I needed a week off afterwards. I was absolutely it's such an intense environment.
It's intense. Yeah, I've been there quite a few times, like as a visitor. Mm-hmm. And a couple of years ago, I was on the Perfect Fit stand as working. That was like for 2 days, but that was enough.
Yeah.
That was really full on. It was so busy, but awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, just to kind of introduce yourself?
Absolutely.
You got started.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously my name is Kamal Fernandez. I am a professional dog trainer and sports dog coach, but also I consult people about behavioral challenges in their dogs. I've been dog training for over 34 years, something like that. So I started off relatively young, and I did what most people did, and I found my way into the world of dogs by having an unruly pet that didn't do as she was told, or she was disobedient. Natural fact, we just didn't teach her anything. We just wondered why the dog didn't respond like an iPhone and just plugged in and went and did as she was told. Funny enough, it took some involvement on our part. So we made loads and loads and loads of mistakes with her as a first time dog owners. And she probably had the majority of behavioral problems and classic training issues that dogs have. You know, she was a resource guarder, she had separation anxiety, she was okay with dogs, but she was nervous around dogs. She definitely had anxiety issues. She was a very complex little soul, but nonetheless, or I say she was a complex soul, she actually was a dog that just wasn't educated, as I said. And as a result, she opened the door to me falling in love with this eclectic mix of the weird and wonderful. And from that initial that dog, her name was Scrunch, I went on and had a bit of success with my subsequent dogs and sort of really immersed myself in the world of dog sports. So that would include obedience, which is where I was competing this weekend. I've also done agility, working trials. I've had a dog that I've did IGP training with. So I've had which is a protection sport. So I've had a really diverse career. And along that path, I've also helped obviously countless people with troublesome dogs and hopefully to lead better lives. So my day-to-day job now is an eclectic mix of sports training and behavioral work and helping people just have nicer pets.
Awesome. So in terms of small dogs, because you have quite, and I know you have quite a lot of dogs, don't you?
Yeah.
Have you had yourself many, many small dogs?
Yes. So at the moment I have two small dogs. One is a German Spitz. He's a Klein Spitz. To be fair, he's technically a Mittel, but he's the size of a Klein. He was an undersized Mittel. And I have Sugar, who is a Jack Russell Poodle cross, probably the size of a male Chihuahua. She's tiny little thing.
I've seen Sugar on quite a few of your videos.
She's an amazing little dog. So I love having small dogs in the house. I love having, I don't know what it is about the dynamics of having a small dog. I think it's that internal puppy size, really, but you definitely feel differently towards them. She gets a lot more privileges than the other dogs. You know, like my dogs generally aren't lying on the furniture. Sugar's like, screw that rule, I'm on the sofa. It is a rule that he's allowed to have the rule, I have to say. But she's the absolute, I would always have a small dog, irrespective of the dogs I've had. And at the moment I have 10 dogs and I have all different, I've had lots of different breeds of dogs. I would always have a small dog. My partner also had a Chihuahua cross, Jack Russell, who lived till he was 17. And I was quite involved with him towards the latter part of his life. He actually lived with me for a period of time. It was actually originally my girlfriend's auntie's dog. She unfortunately passed away. And they were in this limbo about what to do with the dog. And I was like, you know, well, what's another dog? So I had him for... Yeah. It was probably actually close... Now thinking about it, it's probably closer to about a year. But he was a great little dog with a lot of issues, to be truthful. But it was probably mismanagement and misunderstanding and so forth. But he was a great little character. And he had, you know, as lots of dogs do, had loads of quirks that you learn to embrace. And actually it's part of what makes them so, they get under your skin, don't they, you know?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. They're such little characters, aren't they?
Yeah. So yeah. I would always have a small dog. I just don't know what it is about them. And to be truthful, before I got my first small dog, I wasn't anti, but I was like, oh no, I don't want a small dog, you know. But when you have one, I absolutely couldn't imagine my life without one now.
Mm, yeah. And you know, the Jack Russells, the Terriers and the Chihuahuas, they're so kind of spunky, aren't they? And they actually want to work. Some of them quite drivey, aren't they?
Yeah, so, and I think
awesome people, little dogs.
Absolutely. I mean, I think to be honest, that's a lot of why Chihuahuas have behavioral issues, because they're understimulated. Yeah. You know, people, you know, funny enough, I went to a client on this week, and exactly that, the dog Chihuahua, and they just, with the best intentions, they just exercised him in their garden, and that was a huge part of the reason. And you know, and I said, you know, they're an intelligent breed, they need a vocation to do. And it's the ones that I know that I've trained and have been successful have been because they've been stimulated. You know, two that I spring to mind. One was a longtime student. She went to Chihuahua and put a Chihuahua team together for Crufts. Had a Chihuahua. Oh. Yeah, amazing, amazing little dog.
Is it obedience? Obedience.
Yeah, it was obedience. Yeah.
Obedience.
So my student's name was Kathleen, and her little Chihuahua. She put, there was four of them. I trained Kathleen. He was incredible. Absolutely. Wow. Incredible dog. And the other one was a student. She came to me with two. One was called Lucky and Phenomenal. She does hear what to music, and she won again at Crufts with them. She still competes and there. She moved because I moved down here. I don't train that venue anymore. But again, phenomenally intelligent and so smart. Like, you could teach them tricks in literally seconds.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of small breeds is about your perception of them, isn't it, really, rather than the actual dog?
Yeah, I think people think they're not proper dogs, don't they?
Definitely.
That they don't need a purpose. You don't need to do anything with them because they're just small dogs.
Or they just, they they spend their life just holding them, which I get.
Yeah.
I get, you know, one of the draws of getting a small dog is to have a lap dog, to have a dog as a companion and a comforter, so to speak. And I absolutely love that. I mean, Sugar's like, she would spend her, you know, majority of her day happily being cuddled. But you take her out for a walk for 2 hours with my dog, she's the dog that will keep up with everybody else. She doesn't tire. And I think that that's something that certainly with small dogs, I think people have that. I understand it. There's that, it's the balance, isn't it? The need to protect them and keep them safe.
Mm-hmm.
But also you need to treat them. They're a dog at the end of the day and they want to do dog things. They want to, you know, chase, sniffs, you know, hunt, you know, jump on things, go for a swim, you know, all that stuff, the normal stuff, get dirty. Dogs like to do that stuff, roll in, you know, fox poo or whatever it is.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, this little one here, she's just a firecracker. She really, of course, it's just a painting. She's a little firecracker. She really loves, she has to do something every single day to work that brain.
Yeah.
And like you say, she can pick stuff up super quick. Mm-hmm. I know you've got 2 chihuahuas, haven't you, Kate? And they do a lot of training as well.
Yeah, very, very intelligent dogs.
Very, very intelligent. Yeah, very definitely. Trainable. Definitely. You know, and I think, again, it's a perception. A friend of mine in America, she's had chihuahuas for, oh God, 20, 30 years, something like 20 years probably. And anyway, she puts obedience titles on all her chihuahuas. And again, she says they're so trainable. They want to learn. They want to work. They want to, you know, they're normally greedy. They're playful. So it's a shame, isn't it, really, that a lot of people don't do enough with them?
I know. Sorry, go on.
Okay. Hence this podcast.
Yes, exactly. This is why we're kind of, partly why we're here, really.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, I, for my clients, because I specialize in chihuahuas, a lot of my clients, they're actually really surprised when I start training with them. They're really surprised that their dog can do stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh my God, he actually has a brain, he can use it. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. Yeah, so a lot of potential for them.
Absolutely. And I said that, you know, if you were to, I think most people would agree there's certain characteristics that was associate with small, you know, yapping, you know, reactivity, all that sort of stuff, anxiety-based behaviors. If you actually strip it back, it's because they don't have enough purpose and vocation in their life. You know, they haven't gone for a really good walk. They're not physically stimulated, or they're not physically had their needs met. So the devil makes work idle hands. If you have excess energy, and a classic thing that people do, you know, when I worked in London, a lot of people had smaller dogs because, you know, they lived in flats. And as a result, they, you know, to be truthful, a lot of them didn't exercise their dogs enough. And there was no real reason. It was just to, you know, well, it's a small dog. He doesn't need a lot of exercise. You know, that was part of the buy-in as to why they got a small dog. And you'd find the problems would be related to the dog would get almost agoraphobic because they didn't get out in the big wide world and they didn't have their confidence built systematically and they weren't stimulated on a daily basis. And as a result, they would get, I mean, you know, I think the conversation I had with the person the other day was, you know, when we went through lockdown, I think it was a really insightful thing for people to experience. Initially, everybody was having their best life. We were working on our tans and brilliant, you know, it was wonderful, good weather. And as that time period went on and trickled on, you started to get people a bit like, actually, I'm getting a bit anxious. I'm getting a bit depressed. There was definitely some mental health challenges, I'm sure. But I would say most people, because they weren't getting out and about, they weren't meeting their friends and family. They weren't getting that daily stimulation. They didn't have a purpose. You know, they didn't have that job to do or that, you know, that a business to run, et cetera, et cetera. And as a result, I think people felt, you know, what a lot of dogs experience on a daily basis.
I absolutely 100% agree. I think some of the, like, not naughty. Yeah, I'm going to say the naughty ones are the ones that don't have that. They don't have enough physical exercise, the mental stimulation. The ones that get into trouble, I find, are the ones that are kind of like, or they're fearful outside, the ones that are kind of don't do a lot. You know, they're kind of kept inside and sort of kept like a cat, maybe.
Yeah.
We've got this saying on the podcast, like, they're not cats. They're not cats.
Yeah.
Chihuahuas are not cats. Yeah.
And the ironic thing is, whilst people want, cats probably have more freedom.
Actually, you know, that's true.
Because people, again,
do more stuff.
The perception that people, the perception that people have. You know, cats are just let him out the back door, and the cat probably ranges several miles a day, so he's meeting all his needs. But a chihuahua, oh no, I can't let him out the front door because he might get, you know, savaged or eaten by a seagull or whatever the case may be. You kind of go, and what then happens is they make their world literally smaller, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. We've got to change our saying about cats, I think, Kate.
I know. Can we talk about the academy, the dog academy?
Hey.
Happy to talk about, Yeah, so yeah. You've also been involved in some TV work. Was that filmed last year?
That was filmed last year. So it was a really, really, really cool project to be involved in. And hopefully everybody will watch it and support it so that we get another series, fingers crossed. But yeah. It was, I got a call out of the blue from a really great company, and we had to go through a series of essentially auditions, first initially on Zoom, and then I had to go to London. And the premise of the program was one that really, really resonated with me and what I was actually simultaneously, I was plotting actually about doing a YouTube series on a similar vein. So I don't want to give too much away about the essence of the program. Just watch it. It's going to be, I'm going to confidently say there's nothing like it on television at present, you know, and it's not a dog training show. It's about relationships. It's far more, what's the word? It's more empathetic than that, I would say. To just say it's about dog training would do it an injustice. But as I said, they approached me about filming the project. Luckily that I thought was great. They liked me. We filmed up in an amazing, amazing place. It was incredible, up near Staffordshire. And it was for about a month, 6 weeks of filming. There was a team of us put together this project, and essentially having people come to us in various states of disrepair with their dogs' relationships, and also their own personal relationships, and how that the dog's behavior had impacted on various aspects of their life. And we were given the opportunity to work with them and help them. One of the early cases, which I think will be relatively early in the series, is on a Chihuahua, funny enough, who had some challenges, and we were able to work with her. And I don't want to give too much away. I'm trying to think of how to say.
Watch it, guys. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah,
the trailer looks amazing.
It's just the premise of what the program is. And when we have had a little snippet peek of what it's going to look like, and it surpassed even my expectations. So I'm really excited about what that could be. I hope that people support it. You know, it's a really great project. It's really heartwarming. It's very genuine. Because I've been approached by various television companies in the past, and just various things just didn't sit right with me as to why the agenda behind it, or, you know, it was a bit sort of cheesy or tacky. And, you know, that's not my thing, really. And unless it's going to resonate with people and actually do some good, it's not something that I would go, I just want to jump into, you know. It's not the way I operate, you know. And I think because of the reasoning and the logic behind it, I thought, you know what, let's give it a go. So I hope that people enjoy it, and I hope that people see it in the light that it's been intended.
I think a program that's sort of focusing on that relationship between you and your dog, and the empathy, is much, much needed right now in terms of what's on the TV. Well, we're gonna keep everyone up to date with that, aren't we, Kate?
For yes, sure. It's going to be on Channel 4, isn't it? So for our UK listeners, it's Channel 4.
Yeah. It's a team that actually put together the dog house. Is it the dog house that where they help people find dogs, rehome dogs? And so it's that team that put that together, and that's an amazing show. So yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to it.
I'm really looking forward to that as well, actually. Oh, it's going to be crazy. There's other trainers there as well. Yeah, I think Victoria Stillwell's heading everything up, isn't she? So she's like the head honcho.
Victoria's on the team. I've worked with Victoria before on another project I did. Oh God, back 8 years ago.
Oh, was that the
flying dogs?
The flying dogs. Yeah.
Flying dogs.
Yeah, the dogs flying the plane. Yeah. So
a little bit for us.
Yeah. So that project was it was about 8 years ago, because it was just before my daughter was born. And essentially what we did was we took 12 rescue dogs, rehabilitated them, trained them, and three of them went on to essentially fly a plane. So it was a huge project. It took about 6 months. 6 to 10 months of filming. I was more or less there every single day, working with the dogs for about 6 months solid. It was a huge, huge project. But yeah, it was great. And initially, Victoria was one of the trainers and presenters on that program. And it was, you know, obviously Victoria's very, very popular and very well known. And it just so happened that we came together we've come back together on this project. So yeah, there's Victoria, there's Joe Payne, who's just an absolute lovely, lovely. We don't know Joe Payne. Joe Payne is, she's on the Victoria Stillwell Academy. She's just an absolute wonderful human. Adam Danes, excellent, really lovely guy from over Bristol way. Lovely. I've never met them. I met them at conferences, because they were there when I spoke at Victoria's conferences, but I hadn't really had an opportunity to really meet them, talk to them. They are just wonderful. And Sean, who is, he runs a business up in Newcastle. Really, really lovely guy. Ex-rugby footballer, rugby player, I should say, who transitioned into training dogs and working with dogs, and Nancy Creedon from Ireland, who's a behaviourist, and again, really, really, really great bunch of people. It was just a pleasure to work with them all.
What an experience. So, reactivity.
Yes.
What is it? Because I feel like reactivity is a label that's thrown around a lot, isn't
Definitely.
It? Every dog's reactive. And a lot of the time it's just dogs being dogs, normal yeah. dog behaviour. And it's... Yeah. So how would you define reactivity in dogs?
So reactivity, you're absolutely right. It seems to be it's a buzzword in training circles and behaviour used to describe everything from the overzealous greeter to the dog that is severely dog aggressive. And to me, it's too broad an umbrella, and there's too many different things underneath it. And we need to be much more implicit about what we're describing when it comes to behaviour. So reactivity is for me, it's not an act of retaliation. So if a dog rushes in your dog's face and your dog says, go away, that to me isn't reactivity. For me, reactivity is the dog responding to an external stimulus, and it can be based from fear, it can be based from prey drive, it can be based from excitement, and it's the dog essentially acting in a way that we as a society deem is inappropriate. So the dog is doing something probably that's very natural to them, but certainly from a cultural point of view, certainly in a lot of Western cultures, we deem a lot of what dogs do naturally as grossly politically incorrect, shall we say. And we can, you know, we can attach the blame to Disney for that one, to be truthful, you know?
Yeah.
So a lot of reactivity is often fear-based. It's defensive. It's a defensive tactic for dogs when they feel concerned about another dog approaching them or a person or a situation. And the best line of attack is defense. And dogs are reacting or they are responding in a way that is natural to them. Alternatively, it could be the dog is overexcited or it's a prey response. So they see something that causes them to be frustrated or aroused. And as a result of that, they act in a way that, again, is deemed politically incorrect or inappropriate. So there is so many variations of reactivity. Arousal can be a contributing factor. Fear can be a contributing factor. Previous experience can be a contributing factor. But the most common denominator with reactivity is how it affects the owner, and that can often, or the caregiver, and that can often cause the behavior to remain or be exaggerated or exacerbated from what is maybe a very trivial thing to something that can be much bigger. So a classic I talk about the anxiety loop, where a dog that feels anxious towards another dog acts in a way to avoid that situation escalating. So for example, they see another dog approaching them, they fly out and lunge at the other dog, the agenda being to make the dog move away. The owner then gets anxious because that happens, or subsequent, the owner that who owns that second dog gives the person the verbal mouthful, hey, you shouldn't have that dog off the lead, or it should be on the lead, or it should be muzzled, and all the stuff that goes with it. That contributes to the person's anxiety. So the dog that was originally anxious now feels even more anxiety because the owner is transmitting that down the lead. And before you know it, you have this anxiety loop that is rolling, so to speak, and either parties can break out of it. So it can be really, really all-consuming reactivity when you deal with it. I mean, people adapt their life. They manage their dog's behavior so stringently. You know, dogs can be medicated for it, or then people can utilize medication to deal with reactivity. They can even use medication for themselves or self-medicate to deal with the trauma and anxiety that it can create. And for me, that's why it was an area of work, if I'm honest, I didn't intend to speak on so prominently, but as it happens, it's become almost a passion project for me, and that now I have an online course aimed specifically at reactivity and helping people reframe what reactivity is, and also help them overcome the challenges that reactivity causes.
I know what you mean. It does affect the owners, doesn't it? Because then they're anxious and then they're scanning the environment. They've got a dog that's scanning the environment, and they're both just not living their best lives, are they?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's a combination of, the dogs haven't been equipped with the skills to necessarily deal with all of life's ups and downs. And the owner probably hasn't either been equipped with those skills. And it's a combination. I mean, you know, you can have a genetic influence to reactivity. You know, if you have two dogs that have nervous temperaments and you put them together, your chances are you're going to have a litter of nervous puppies. And those puppies are going to go out in the big wide world and affect their owners and so forth and so forth. And, you know, I would say, you know, we're talking about this is a Chihuahua podcast. It seems to be the accepted norm that Chihuahuas are barky. So therefore, you know, it's just the way they are. So people then, breed two really barky Chihuahuas, and then you get a litter of whole barky Chihuahuas, and that cycle then ensues, rather than reframing our perception of the dog and the breed. And yes, I understand that the breeders originally, you know, they were alarm. They're essentially a warning dog. You know, they're a mini guard dog. I understand that. But also we need to reframe it and understand that, yes, the dog might be barky, but we also need to build confidence in. So we need to dog train around them as well, around some of the issues as well.
Because it shouldn't be accepted norm that they all just react and go crazy on the lead, because I don't think people understand why they're doing that. And a lot of the time, I think, especially with the smaller dogs, it is fear-based. You know, tiny, and the world is a big, scary place if you're that tiny.
I think it's definitely, that's a factor. I think it's that, but it's also, I think, where when you have a small dog, you are, I absolutely understand, you know, you are uber protective of the experiences they have. So, you know, the overzealous chocolate Labrador, and it always seems to be chocolate Labradors, you know, that bolts into your small dog can do some serious damage. So the dog that I was talking about earlier, Cecil, he was 17 years old, and originally he lived in the family home. He lived in the family home with a large Labrador, huge Labrador. He was a show type Labrador, had a massive, massive head. So when I first met my girlfriend, there was a huge thing in their house of Cecil would attack the Labrador. And it was, and to the point of where if they had to shut doors and they couldn't, then if ever the two, it was like, you'd think that like Cujo had entered the building. It was absolutely ridiculous. And it was because he was fearful, because what had happened was the Labrador had bowled him over several times. So Cecil went, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get you first. Because his head was probably the time size of Cecil. And you go, of course he's going to be worried about it. And the ironic thing is actually Cecil was absolutely brilliant with other dogs. He had amazing dog skills, but clearly this other dog didn't read them, bolstered into him, and that made him reactive, which then made the house anxious because of the behavior and so forth and so forth. And nobody realized, you know, they used to think that Cecil had a temperament problem, and I was like, Cecil's absolutely great. That dog's basically the drunk person at the pub that's really overzealous and wants to give you a hug and a kiss, and you're like, oh good, can you get out of my face? So that's I absolutely understand how that can happen. The caveat to that is, I always urge people with any dog, whether it be small, medium or large, is to employ the goodwill of others and friends and family members and start to create a little bubble, so to speak, around your puppy, and expose them to other dogs that are going to create positive experiences. So I have a litter of puppies at the moment, and they've systematically met all my dogs. And they've done it in a controlled manner. Now, like I can happily have the puppies with all my dogs, but I've done it in a way that initially it was my small dogs. So Sugar and Sonic first, because I know they're going to be safe. They're not going to do any damage to the puppy, because even just the sheer dynamics, if you have a 4-week-old puppy and a big dog and they just go nose them, that could really, really traumatize that puppy. So again, it's done systematically. So as they gained in confidence and they got older, I then expose them to the female dogs. The reason being is that my female dogs are more maternal. Several of them have had puppies. They're going to be mindful of the puppies, of the tiny babies. So just taking that little bit of consideration, and then systematically the older dogs and the male dogs, and the male dogs I left till last, not because my male dogs are horrible, but just the sheer physicality, they're that little bit bigger, they're more powerful. So I want to make sure that the puppies are more robust and that I can control that interaction. So taking that principle when you're introducing any dog to a new situation can help you navigate and create a dog that's well adjusted. Distance is always your friend. Yeah, if you're not confident, comfortable, create distance away from the second dog and allow your puppy to observe. You know, I'm a great believer in allowing them to organically see and take things in. But if I really felt concerned, I would take some treats and pair higher value reinforcement with those experiences. And less is more. You know, if you're going to take your puppy out for a play date with another dog. 5 minutes, right, let's reassess, how's this all going? Are both puppies happy? Right, and 10 minutes and increase it gradually. And try and quit while you're ahead. Don't leave it for an hour when both dogs get a bit tetchy and then it can go to the proverbial. But I think that it's, I absolutely empathize with people. I mean, I you know, Sugar's got an amazing, amazing temperament. But I'm still, when I meet dogs, I'm always observing their language, their body language, so that she doesn't, she's never put in a position of jeopardy.
No, and that's a really important thing that you've touched on, isn't it? It's about being mindful of your dog and other dogs, and it mindful of the environment. Like my Chihuahua, she's got a really good temperament, she's really solid, but I would never put her in a situation where she would feel like she had to protect herself, or
absolutely,
you know, I'm very mindful of the environment and what's going on.
Absolutely, but mindfulness doesn't need to be based from anxiety. Like if I took my daughter out, I'm mindful. Like if I just take my daughter to the park, I'm mindful. I'm observing who she's playing with, how big are those kids, are they, you know, getting a bit rough, you know, what equipment is she playing on, what footwear was she wearing. So in my head, I'm going through this dynamic risk assessment to go, is she safe? Yep, she's safe, carry on. Yeah. Does she look apprehensive? Is that, do I anticipate something happening there? I'm going to just walk a bit closer and just be a little bit more in proximity so that they know that I'm there. I'm not going to rush in and rescue her or save her, because everything's fine. I'm just monitoring. And that's something that I always urge people to do. Don't rush in and be so on guard that you create that tension. Like why are you acting odd? Why are you being all stiff? And again, learn to be, you know, to play act. If you are anxious, learn to, you know, be aware of your body language, you know, relax your shoulders a bit, take a deep breath, let it out, relax yourself and act from a place of clarity.
And would you say that that helps with their confidence as well? So, because it's kind of like they go together, don't they? A more confident dog is not going to be so react from fear, essentially.
Absolutely. You know, the greatest gift you can give a dog is confidence. You know, forget anything else, doesn't matter, the nice meatiest bone, the best treat, the gift you should be giving them is confidence. And I think the same of, you know, rearing children or raising children, I should say, that if you can create confidence with them, the world is their oyster. And if they don't have confidence, they're going to live in a bubble and a place of isolation. So my feeling is this is to create confidence. And confidence is about a series of interactions that build on that confidence and done in layers. So, you know, I'm not going to let my puppy run with, you know, three adolescent male dogs that are a little bit tetchy and testosterone is brewing. I'm not going to let my puppy mix with those dogs. I'm going to let my puppy mix with the older dog that's, you know, a bit more calm and chilled and sedate, or a dog that is smaller, so they can be a little bit fast and furious. But when they do that, I'm going to allow them to do it in my garden, so there's open space, there's nothing that they can hurt themselves. So it's always about evaluating situation to situation and not being so overprotective where I end up creating an anxiety issue and I make my dog's world smaller and they don't meet other dogs, they don't meet other people. Now the contradiction to that is I don't actually make a point of over socializing my dogs. So when I say that, let me just be clear, I don't go through the 100 dogs to meet in a day. I pick and choose situations that I manipulate and I create. So if I know that my neighbor has a dog that's robust and social, I'm going to arrange to that them to meet on neutral territory. If my family member has a dog that's super social and sweet, I'm going to arrange to meet them, etc. If I have a friend that has a wheelchair, I'm going to get my puppy to meet somebody in a wheelchair. If I have a friend that has blind or have sight issues and has a walking stick, I'm going to interact them with that. So what I'm doing is integrating my puppy into situations that I can control all the moving parts.
It's quality, isn't it? Quality over quantity.
Absolutely. That's important. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And sorry, I'm on my soapbox here about socialization. Mindful when your dogs go through developmental stages. So the first one's going to be that initial fear period. Normally 12 to 14 weeks to 15, 16 weeks, your puppy's going to, every dog is going to go through a fear period. Yeah. It normally coincides with teething. They get sensitive around their face. They get, you know, imagine when you've got toothache, sounds start to get a bit more sensitive. You get sensitive to sound, you get sensitive to touch, you don't want people around here. So if you let your puppy as teething interact with another puppy and they rush up and put their face to the puppies, that's going to make them have a pain association. Before you know it, you have a dog that's reactive to dogs approaching them. So when my dogs are in that place, I don't allow them to meet new dogs. So bearing in mind, up until that point, I've probably got a little group of dogs that I can socialize my dog with. And in that period of fear, I go back to my bubble and I only mix them with dogs that they know. The reason being is there's a possibility that if they do have a negative experience, they're going to chalk it up as, oh, that was a bit strange. Don't know why that happened. I've had lots of good experiences with that particular dog. That must have just been a one-off. And there's a possibility that they can move through that experience without any long-term issues. Similarly, when the puppy enters adolescence, irrespective of the dog, normally 6 months to 10 months, they're going to enter adolescence, maybe a bit older for the larger dogs. Certainly with the younger dogs, you want to be, certainly some male chihuahuas, they can go into puberty quite young. 6 months, they can, you know, testosterone can be raging. So you want to be thinking about who they interact with. If you, you know, boys will be boys. If you let your teenage boy, you know, go out partying with these other teenage boy mates, the chances are they're going to get in trouble. So let's just now think a little bit more about who they interact with so that there isn't any shoulder pushing or posturing, which can then escalate into an issue before you know it.
Speaking about socialization, I feel like that's where a lot of the problems start, isn't it?
Definitely.
Because people, they either over socialize or they don't socialize at all.
Absolutely. I would say all the behavioral cases that I primarily deal with, I would say the vast majority are created in adolescence, and they are normally created through an issue through socialization, either putting the dog in the deep end or the world has been so small, the dog hasn't learnt to deal with the weird and wonderful. And, you know, I think there's a balance between keeping your dog safe and also exposing it to the world where sometimes things are a bit odd. And you've got to learn to, oh, OK, that's a strange thing. That's a strange noise. Don't panic. Allow the dog to figure it out. You know, people are so quick to either intervene with food or removing the dog rather than just going, let the dog process. So, you know, I breed border collies, and it's so interesting watching them learn about life. So, you know, when you first put the Hoover on, for example, they'll all go like panic. They'll all huddle together out of a, or we'll feel, like, oh my God, what the hell was that? Now, you could make it easier for them. You could put it on softer. You could put it all, there's loads of things that you can do. Most of the time, and this is what's happened with every litter I do, because it happens, you know, so often, whenever I switch the Hoover on, I might do it in another room. Within a matter of repetitions, they're like, oh, it's just that funny noise. Okay, nothing happened to us. We'll carry on doing the thing that we do. Now, sometimes I might put their food down as I do it. Sometimes the mother will be there with them. Sometimes it won't. And they learn just to go, oh, it's just that funny noise. It was just something that becomes background noise. Are you with me? So often you'll find with puppies, certainly, you'll find an extreme fear response. They will go panic. Oh my God, what the hell's that? Of course they will. That's normal. They don't know what that is. But rather than letting them just figure it out and going, yeah, have a look, sniff, walk up to it, back off, walk up to it again, back off again. That's fine. Figure it out. Let's sit here and just watch the scary thing from a distance. When you're ready, we'll venture closer. And letting them just organically figure out, oh, okay, just being silly. There's nothing to worry about. And off we trundle. Yeah. So that's a really, really an important thing to consider. And I often will use what I call an anchor dog. So Sugar, bless her, is the poster child for anchor dogs. And I use her a lot of the time to give other dogs confidence. So I had a Dachshund that came to me for residential training called George, and she was a massive, massive part of helping him gain confidence, because she green lighted situations. So she would approach people and say hello, and then he would get curious and then venture up to them. She would approach the other dog and sort of interact, and he would then follow her lead. So if you have older dog that's confident and experienced, using that dog to build your other dog confidence is a really useful tool.
Yeah, I do a lot of that with clients. I call them like buddy dogs. You know, just bringing the dog in to, just like you say, green light that situation. And I think what a lot of people do is they make a big thing, like if their puppy's scared of something, they make a big thing out of it. And they don't allow, in general, I don't think people allow enough processing, enough waiting and watching to see what their puppy actually does. Everything's all like, I think it's just the way we live now. Everything's just such a rush. You know, there's a rush to get them in with other dogs. There's rush them through this. There's rush them through this walk. And what they need to do is actually stop and take a breath and just allow the puppy to watch.
Yeah, I always explain it. It's the smash glass in the bar scenario. So, you know, like, funny enough, we were at dinner at Crufts and everything's, we're chatting away. Suddenly out of nowhere, crash, bang, one of the waitresses dropped a table full of glasses. The whole place instantly stopped, dead silent, right? And then in seconds, we all went, oh, it's that, and then we carried on. So that moment of silence is natural. It's normal for you to go, what the hell was that? Mm. Oh, okay, let me assess it. Let me look at it. Oh, it's just glasses. And we then go along. It would be weird if that happened and nobody responded. That would be, in my opinion, be, yeah, like, why? There's something wrong with you. Are you all deaf? Are you lost your hearing?
Yeah.
are your senses not working? So it's normal for your puppy to go, oh my God, what is that? It's what they do afterward. Mm. It's what the recovery period that is really the crucial thing. You know, and when I'm looking at my puppies and when I sort of assess them, one of the things I test is recovery to stress. So I will take them in an environment where they haven't been before, and I'll present them with an item they've never seen before, and I'll watch what they do. It might be something that makes a noise or moves around a bit obscurely, and they'll often go, oh my God, what is that? Oh, I'm in a strange place. And what I'm noting is how quickly does the puppy go, oh, okay, it's nothing to worry about. That's a key thing for good temperament in dogs and allowing your dog to have that to show that natural response.
And the more they do that, the more confident they become, don't they? The more they do it, the better they get. Yeah, they build resilience and they get better at that recovery.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's a bit like, you know, my daughters go swimming every week. And, it, you know, when she was younger, she obviously was in a heated pool. Now she's in a pool where it's a big pool and it's the initial shock of the cold. So initially it was like, oh my God, the cold, cold, cold. You get in, once you're in the water, you're fine. And so now each time she goes, she gets less concerned about the initial, the temperature change because she becomes accustomed to it. Oh, okay. All right. 1, 2, 3, boom, in, right, done. Let it go. And it gets better and better. Now she's like, okay, it's a non-event. Like she sits in the puts her anything. There's a bit of trepidation about, oh, it's going to be the cold, bump in, that's it. Then it's forgotten. Mm. Initially, it was like, oh my God, it's the cold water. And each time it's got better and better and better. So, and it's not that we did anything. We didn't go in there and hold her hand and that. We allowed her to figure it out. Mm. Figure out that it's only cold water. It's going to be fine. You're safe. There's people around. It's not going to hurt you. It's just cold water. And that's the thing that we should be looking at in behavior, you know. Assessing, is it just cold water or is it, oh, are they going to drown? And that's a different scenario. And then that's where I would absolutely intervene. If I thought, okay, the water's too deep, or, you know, there was a current, or it was open sea, my risk assessment's going to be very different. But when it's somewhere that I can monitor and go, okay, there's people around, it's a pool, there's loads of people, there's people that's trained, somebody's in the water, an adult's in the water, she gets in the cold water, it's fine, she'll be absolutely fine. And what I'm watching for the sidelines, and my body language is conveying to her, it's fine, I'm neutral. Okay, don't worry about it, it's fine. It's only cold water. Yeah. I might even laugh and sort of give her a thumbs up. Excellent when you're in there, you know? Now it's a bit of an ongoing joke. She beams at me and she's like, ooh.
Yeah.
So it's part of when you're, you know, if we take that back to behavior and with dogs, we need to be applying that principle. It's only cold water.
Yeah, nothing to worry about.
Yeah, it's like almost like you have a child and you're sort of just acting. Isn't it? Yeah. A lot of my clients are just act, you know, act like everything's fine, it'd be fine. Make light of it, you know.
Definitely.
Make light of it. So when people are actually walking, so going back to chihuahuas, so when people are walking their chihuahuas, what sort of walking equipment would you recommend that they to prevent, maybe prevent reactivity, or what sort of thing would you recommend that they walk their dogs on?
I personally walk my dogs on flat collars. But the caveat to that is, my dogs are on a flat collar. They have had training to understand, don't pull me on a flat collar. Now, that's done using reinforcement, but there's an interim period where my dogs don't have that skill. So when they're babies, I put them on a harness. I put them in a harness because I don't care that they pull. A harness is designed to make pulling easier and to facilitate pulling, as it were, to make it physically more comfortable to pull. I don't want to put restrictions on my dog, so I'm happy for them to pull in a harness. That's also beneficial for other training that I do. Simultaneously to that, I'm teaching my puppy when it's on a flat collar, they need to be engaged with me, or, you know, loosely walking. And that takes a period of time. You know, it would take months and months and months and months to teach a puppy to really understand not to pull you on a lead. So I'm running the two things concurrently, and I advise people to make a choice based on your own personal preference. Okay, is the first thing. If I personally, you should prefer my dogs on collars, but I'm not anti-harnesses. I think harnesses are brilliant. And certainly for small dogs, I would probably say they're probably a safer option. But I would say using something like an extended lead is going to teach a dog to pull. Extended leads specifically teach dogs to pull because the dog is getting reinforced. As it puts tension on the lead, it's being reinforced by getting to go further and further and further. Now, the other caveat to using a harness is that you have little control of the dog's head. And if the dog is focusing forward, it can often create opposition reflex, which is effectively one of the benefits of a harness. In the conversational behavior, that can be counterproductive because the dog is now, it's like you're holding them back and they want to get to the thing. So that can be escalating the arousal level. So it really is about personal preferences. I personally prefer to use collars. I will use a harness when my dogs are puppies or younger. And if they're in a, you know, a situation where I have no issue with them pulling, et cetera. My preference is to teach them to walk on a loose lead, or until that skill's available to me, I avoid them being in situations where on a collar where they're going to rehearse the inappropriate response. Certainly for small dogs, I would say using a collar, a flat collar or a harness is probably safer for them. And thinking about whether you use, I personally would suggest using a long line trailing, but there is obviously, like with everything, with every tool that you use, there's always a small print. Flat collars are my preference, but there's a small print to a flat collar. The same with harnesses, same with long line, same with everything tool that you use, there is a need to be aware of how you use it. So when I will use a long line on a young dog when I feel that at that stage where they might be testing boundaries, and I don't use it to reel them in. I use it as a safety net. So if my puppy does make a beeline for the main road, hypothetically, I can put my foot on that dog and I can capture it. I'm not training the dog. That's not me teaching the dog to come back because it has a long line. It's just merely to keep it safe. So certainly for small dogs, I would say probably using either a collar or a harness and making sure that you're teaching them to walk on a loose lead or some sort of engagement. You know, with certain bigger dogs, I've advised people to use either no pull harnesses or head collars if it's more appropriate for them. Again, there's pros and cons to both of those items, and it's about really doing the due diligence of what suits you as an individual, to be truthful.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Preferences? Sorry, go on. Just out of curiosity.
I prefer harnesses for my guys, yeah. Just because they are so tiny. I worry about their neck, yeah. But I also do a lot of focus at, like, they can walk on a loose lead on their harness.
Yeah.
I do a lot of focus on me training when I'm out. Yep. So they're not out there scanning the environment looking for something to shout at.
I think I work with a lot of chihuahuas that literally have no focus on their owner at all. They're just looking, scanning all the time. So I think it's also what you're teaching them as well.
Definitely.
I find with the extendable leads, they're kind of just, they've got the dog on the handle, they're out there, they're like a loose cannon, they're just out there on their own.
And you know what? But the other thing about flexes is it almost creates a licensed detachment, I suppose, is the way, in that, my dog's a flexi,
I can be like a dog on a handle.
And it doesn't create a connection, it doesn't create a presence, because, well, I've got a flexi, he can roam around, I'm talking to whatever, I'm on my phone. Like my dogs, I walk all my dogs together. I have 10 dogs, they all walk off lead together, they all come back. They all to wait when I want. If I need to put them on leads, they'll all walk on a loose lead. I don't expect my dogs to walk by my side because, to be honest, pragmatically, to have 10 dogs this side is going to be... So as long as they don't drag me, I'm good with it, yeah? They can walk... Some, like Sugar and Sonic tend to walk behind me. I think they do that from a space point of view. The bigger dogs tend to be at my sides or slightly ahead, but they don't drag me, so I can have everybody in lead. But that's trained, that's taught, and it takes time, to be honest, you know? So it's worth investing. But you're absolutely right. I think the biggest consistent issue that people have is they don't engage with their dogs when they're out on a dog walk. Like I'm always engaging with my dogs in some way, shape or form. It doesn't mean I'm on their case, because I also believe they need to have downtime, but I'm calling them back, you know, even just as a byproduct of walking in public spaces. Come back, wait there, let the person pass, let me reward you, off you go, come back, lie down, everybody passes, come back, let's go swimming, we're changing direction. So there's a constant like conversation that happens naturally or not organically on a walk. You know, like I live in a place where there are lots of sheep, so, you know, I have to be aware my dogs aren't trained not to respond to sheep, but I don't want them to be, especially if they're in lambing or they've got lambs, I don't want them to go to the periphery of the sheep or within a certain proximity, because it can cause the sheep to run, because they see a dog or they see a dog near the fence line and they associate that with sheepdog and it can make them spook. So I tend to keep my dogs off that. So if I see them going to that space, I always am calling them back, change the direction. When I'm on a walk, I like to do lots of route changes, so the dogs have to be attentive to me. All that stuff creates a dog that's engaged. And for me, I think often what happens with dog owners is they let the dog off the lead and then they get it back on the end of the lead after, and it's like they're oblivious largely to what happens in between. And
100%, yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's such a, you're missing out on such a great part of owning a dog. You know, like that, walking my dogs is my daily meditation. I absolutely love walking my dogs. I love walking my dogs because of the way they're all social, and because they have a level of training, I've got some control over them. Now, they are dogs and I'm not foolhardy, so I would, you know, if I saw somebody with an out of control dog or dog that I didn't think I would absolutely call my dogs, because I go, mm-hmm. I want to cause an issue, you know. But I get so much joy from being around them because I can enjoy them and they're not being problematic.
I love that, how about having a conversation on your walk and being just engaged. This is what I'm like with my dogs. Like we'll have that conversation on a walk. They'll look back to me. I'll have a little, you know, I'll reward them for check-ins, looking back at me. Yeah. I'll do some little bit of practice recall. We'll do some stays and stuff like you, Kamal. And we're actually having a conversation on our walk. I'm just not just letting them off and just, you know, half an hour off you go. Yeah, I love that. And I think that's missing with a lot of dog owners, yeah, especially small dog owners.
Another thing that I think that so many people they're meeting the dog's needs as an animal, like they're feeding it, they're giving it warmth, they're meeting it, they've given it a bed, you know, somewhere to sleep, etc. Yeah. When you actually strip back their life, you go, but how much joy does this dog have in its day? Is the dog going for a really good walk? Is it having some sort of interaction or connection with you other than just a bowl that comes out from the cupboard and is filled up with some, you know, food and put down the floor? That's not really interaction. And if you, again, it's that thing of, you know, again, we take it back to our children, or certainly my daughter, in her day, like get up in the morning, we've got a series of things that we do, get ready for school, she goes on her iPad, I make her breakfast, so we're engaging. Then she gets up, we go to school, we have a conversation, I pick her up, we have our little things that we do after school, she goes to a post-school activity, she comes back, we have our little bedtime routine, read a book, and it's like a series of things that happens in her day, and not to mention what goes on in her day. And all that stimulation ends up with her like ready to go to bed, because she's had a really full, and sensory wise she's had lots of information, so she's ready for her bed and she's stimulated. And you think a lot of dogs, you know, especially if I'm being truthful, small dogs, they wake up, they go out on the balcony on their little thing, they go back in, they hang around their person all day, which is, you know, not, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, and then they repeat that cycle. And you know, it's often, you think when you actually strip it back, you go, wow, they just see these four walls. I mean, they're nice walls, they're a nice color. But you go, the dog doesn't be interested in it. The dog goes, I want to be running, I want to be sniffing, I want to be, you know, reading a newspaper, like a sensory newspaper of who's been here before, and was it male, was it female, how big, how small, you know, what do they have going on with their health? They've taken that all in. It's like they're reading the Daily Digest. And I think that's something that is the biggest misconception about dog ownership and why we have dogs with behavioral problems. They just aren't fulfilling their canine needs. And specifically, things that are breed characteristics. Like your border collie needs to act like a border collie. It needs to have a daily dose of border collie medication. So that means some sort of herding, running activity. Your spaniel needs to be off sniffing, because that's a very natural spaniel. Your chihuahua needs to rehearse some sort of like centurion-esque activity where you watch things.
Right. I'm trying to think what that would be.
Yeah. But do it in a way that's healthy, you know, like, you know, teach your dog to look at things and look back at you and pay you attention and focus on you, because we and do a little brain game, like teach it a little trick that the dog can do, you know. So do a really long recall, so up a hill, so it has to really use that body energy to get up.
Yeah,
you know, things
love
like
it.
Teach it to do parkour, jump on a chair, just things with them, you know, make it interesting.
Yeah, make them use their brain, because I feel like some people are like, oh, they get a lot of attention, as in they get a lot of cuddles and stuff, but that's not enough, is it? And can you imagine if that was like a human's life? It would be really depressing. Yeah. You'd be depressed, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it really would.
Mind numbing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if one of our listeners has an issue with their chihuahua on walks, they're barking and lunging at other dogs, they're barking and lunging at people, they're not focusing on their owner, and they need some help, what can they do right now?
Okay, so first thing is ditch your dog bowl. No longer feed the dog from a dog bowl. Allocate its meals and use those as training treats to interact with your dog through the day. Okay, if that's rule one. Second thing is, I want you to keep a diary of what your dog is doing. So we need data. What is the dog reacting to? Is it people? Is it dogs? Is it sets? Is it sounds? Let's start collating that information. Okay. Secondly, is get a good harness flat collar and a double lead so that you've got two points of contact, and start to teach that dog some simple behaviors. Sit down, come, you know, do some tricks if you want, so that you're starting to engage with it, work the dog's brain. Start to pay attention to your recall. How good is your recall? And you know, a great saying by a very, very amazing dog trainer called Susan Garrett, she says the recall is a reflection of your relationship with your dog. So let's start working in your recall, start playing recall games. So those simple things are going to create a dog that's more confident. It's going to create a dog that's more focused on you. And if the dog is focused on you, it's not going to be so concerned about what's going on in the big wide world. And the other thing is, I always say to people, in my opinion, there's a gross misconception that we should be having constantly calm dogs. Don't aspire for calmness, aspire for contentment. Because if you have a content dog, the dog will be calm as a byproduct of being content. So aspire on a daily basis to make sure that your dog is content. Yeah, has it had its needs met physically, mentally, emotionally? Check those things off on a daily basis, and you will see an absolutely different, a massive difference in your dog's behavior.
I love it.
So if people want to get hold of you, where can they contact you?
So if you want to reach out to me, and if you have any questions, or you know, you want some support with your dog, you can check out my Facebook page, which is Kamal Fernandez Dog Training, my website, which is kamalfernandez.co.uk, and I'm also on Instagram, which is Kamal Fernandez Dog Training. So any one of those platforms, you can reach out to me. If you've got a dog that's reactive, you can go relabelingreactivity.co.uk, and you can join up my course, which is currently open if you want to sign up. So I'm not sure when this is going to air, but again, if you're interested in that, retrospectively contact me and I'm sure we can work something out.
Absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much, Kamal. We really enjoyed that. It's been amazing talking to you, so we're really honored to have you on and talk about that.
Since recording this episode, the Dog Academy has aired on Channel 4, and there are currently two episodes available to watch on demand. So for our UK listeners, you can catch it on All 4, which is Channel 4's on-demand service, and you can watch it every Thursday at 8 p.m. on Channel 4. And our international listeners are going to have to wait a little bit longer to be able to watch the Dog Academy. But if you are in the UK, please make sure to check it out. It is a fantastic show. I hope that you've enjoyed this episode with Kamal Fernandez in our Industry Expert series. To make sure that you don't miss out on future episodes, please make sure to hit the subscribe button wherever you're listening to your podcasts. And if you would like to get in touch with us, please go to our Facebook page, which is The Chihuahua Podcast. If you have any questions or comments, you can comment on the post for this episode, or you can send us a message. Our email address is thechihuahuapodcast@gmail.com, and we will catch you in the next episode.